place is different. Special. The others don't want to talk about it because it scares them. But we all know it. We all feel it. Do you really think all this is an accident? That we, a group of strangers, survived? Many of us with just superficial injuries? You think we crashed on this place by coincidence? Especially this place? We were brought here for a purpose, for a reason, all of us. Each one of us was brought here for a reason.
Brought here. And who brought us here, John?
The island.
Two players, two sides. One is light, one is dark.
I see you in another life, brother. We have to go back!
Hello and welcome to The Storm, a Lost Rewatch podcast. My name is Dave Gonzalez, and in my case, there would be a toy from my past, and it would be a Baghead Spider-Man, which is a Spider-Man action figure where he's wearing a Fantastic Four suit, and he has a paper bag over his head.
My name is Joanna Robinson, and if there were a toy in a case from my childhood that really epitomized my growing up, it would be a headless Barbie doll. I'm happy to tell that full story if anyone is interested.
And I'm Neil Miller, and if I were to find, or if you were to find something in a case that is from my childhood, I think it would be the Lego Spaceman, the same one that Charlie Day voiced in the Lego movie, but one of the original blue Spaceman little guys.
Oh, yeah. That I would always get like buried in with the Duplos, and then I would never find them ever again. Mm-hmm. And off they went, probably donated to some preschool. Sigh.
Pretty much.
Unfortunately, this podcast is about toys from our childhood, even though now I'm realizing we all have like answers that provoke a certain kind of nostalgia. Maybe it should be. No, it is about Lost, the ABC series Lost. We're rewatching it starting from season one, episode one. We are now 12 episodes into the first season of Lost. This week's episode, whatever the case may be, is a Kate episode. It is the beginning of the back half of season one of Lost. We're going to take a little bit of break between the end of Lost, which will be a monster-sized podcast episode for Exodus parts 1, 2, and 3. But after we run out of Lost season one, we're not going to jump directly into Man of Science, Man of Faith. We're going to have a little bit of mystery time as the storm goes elsewhere, follows the winds, if you will. We're going to blow on over to Star Wars land. Now, I know we've hinted that we knew what was coming up. We for sure know now that it is a series of Star Wars podcasts. You might have heard that this December, there's a Star Wars movie coming out. It's called Rise of Skywalker, and they're marketing it as the end of the Skywalker saga. So that's at least 9 movies that we're going to be talking about. The Star Wars universe is also much more expansive, so I would expect that to sort of spill over, maybe into bonus content, maybe into more podcasts. Who knows? But if Lost isn't your thing and you've been listening to try to figure out what's next, or if you have friends that are on that train, make sure and let them know the next thing is Star Wars. I don't know if they don't like Star Wars, like how we could get any broader than that. So that might be a problem we have to solve with some little bonus podcasts in between. Point being, stay subscribed. We're halfway through season one of Lost, which has been great, by the way. We're still in a run of amazing Lost episodes. This one, I think, has a little bit less flashback than other ones, which means we get a little bit more island drama, but I'm getting way ahead of myself because we all know what comes after Dave describing the show is Joanna Robinson with reviews.
I did want to say that my plan as it stands right now is to do some bonus podcast episodes about both Watchmen and His Dark Materials. I might have some different co-hosts for that, but that will be definitely in our Patreon feed. So if you want to hear me talking about those shows, on this show, on this Storm umbrella, we will have Storm Watchmen and Storm His Dark Materials. We cannot let those shows go by without me talking your ear off about them. So that is all happening. Whether or not the boys come with me is up to them, but they are not required. All right.
I think I'm going to watch both of those things at the very least.
Yeah, Neil said that he might pop in a little bit, but we're all very busy, so I will not overcommit my friends. All right. Yes, Dave?
Oh, no, I was just going to say I could talk about my mongoose, Damon, but other than that, I would have to see how the series goes. Sorry, continue.
Whatever the case may be, they might show up, they might not, but here come some reviews. This one's 5 stars, love Lost, love this podcast, Spike, love 51. Nope, I already read this one. Never mind. So then it's just the only new one we have then is this 3-star one from Strut and Crow, Lost. Listening to Lost Rewatch Pod and Lost is the perfect fit. I can't tell if they're into the show, but the quote-unquote recaps and discussion give you zero clue of what they're actually talking about. No setup of scenes or description of what they're discussing hopefully will improve. I don't know if Strut and Crow dropped that review before Neil started recapping the episodes at the beginning of the episode, podcast episode. We added that in response to some, you know, feedback from people saying they felt a little disoriented and if we could, you know, recap the episode for them. So that's something that Neil is doing beautifully, and hopefully that satisfies that critique. If you have a critical and or non-critical review that you want to leave and you want to drop us those 5 stars and say whatever you want, you are allowed to do that over on iTunes, and we would greatly appreciate it.
Excellent. Neil, we also get feedback from our listeners at our many points of contact now that we're the Storm Podcast that you collect into found signals.
Wait, really?
Yes.
Quickly? Really quickly? I forgot my other job, which is to get people super hype about the guest we have on this week's episode, which is Nerdist Lindsay Romaine. The lovely Lindsay Romaine, one of my favorite people on the planet, will be here to talk about her love of Kate Austin. So, you know, stay tuned for that. That will be coming.
That's going to be fun.
A little later on. When Lindsay loves something, she's very convincing. So all you Kate skeptics, be prepared to be argued into submission. We'll see. We'll see.
I'm glad someone who loves Kate will be on to help us contextualize Kate, who I think, you know, gets some sudden rabid character development this episode. But first, Neil, found signals.
Yes, here are the places where we collect the signals. You can always email us, hosts@stormpodcast.com. You can get us over at stormpodcast.com. You can tweet at us @stormpodcast. And don't forget, you can get all kinds of bonus content, including the things that Joanna just talked about, at patreon.com/stormofspoilers. This week, I have selected an email from Josh. As you know, we're still in sort of the early parts of our rewatch here, and I am obsessed with everyone's stories of how they came to Lost. So here's Josh's. He goes, Lost was the first real show I binged and also had as weekly appointment television. During Christmas break of my sophomore year of college, I was in need of something to do. I was working and all my friends were home for the holidays. Aw. So I had a lot of free time around work. At the store, I saw a DVD box set of Lost Season 1. I had heard good things and it was on sale, so I thought, why not? I ended up buying Season 2 and Season 3 box sets and binging all 3 seasons in just a few weeks before Season 4 premiered. I was hooked. Then I got involved in online communities and started tossing around theories as I anxiously awaited new episodes and suffered the breaks between seasons. As I've watched shows like Breaking Bad, Mad Men, Game of Thrones, I've thought maybe I found a new favorite show, but then I would return back to Lost. Just something about the character work, the mysteries and action just works for me. To avoid getting too spoilery, I may be one of the few who loved the final season and the finale because it really focused on the characters and what they had gone through. Yes, I could have gone for more answers, but the characters were always number one for me in Lost. I picked this one for 2 reasons. One is that Joanne and I were just talking about how it feels like appointment viewing it's not quite dead yet, but it's very much not in vogue these days. And also, shout out to the character work on Lost. It's got some great character work. So I don't know. You guys don't need me to tell you this. You're already listening to the podcast. Anyway, those are the signals I found this week.
can I add one as well? This is also a calm signal. This is just some feedback from Michael who, you know, I don't need to read Michael's whole email, but he's just basically saying like, not a critique because it's a lovely positive email, but maybe like when we talk about the episode, maybe we need to pause and really try to see it from like a newcomer's point of view when it's like, the reveal of Ethan is like, holy shit, there's other people on this island. You know what I mean? Like, maybe we're not taking the full gravity of, holy shit, there's a piece of metal on the ground, or holy shit, there are other people on this island, or whatever the case may be. So, I don't know. Just a reminder to myself to really try to remember how I felt when these various revelations come down, and pause at least to discuss.
So. More all caps in my notes, in my recap notes.
Let's do it, bud.
I mean, I can do it.
It's calm time.
All right. This week, in whatever the case may be, which is an episode directed by Jack Bender. We love Jack Bender. Written by Damon Lindelof and Jennifer Johnson. Correct me if I'm wrong, but aren't both the Kate episodes, they have women writers on them. This is just a trend to track.
Better than Game of Thrones. Sorry. What?
lots of stuff happened this week. So I will give you some fun bullet points. Well, hopefully fun. On the island, we open with Kate climbing a tree, which is a very Kate thing to do. Sawyer is outed as the guy stalking her through the woods and gets his damn knee banged up. They go for a sexy swim and find dead bodies. They also find a case. They spend the rest of the episode flirt fighting through the jungle over the case. That's a new favorite phrase of mine, flirt fighting. Love it. Back on the beach, Saeed is no longer sure about the others based on the fact that Rousseau has likely lost touch with reality. But he does pursue... He remember those notes that he stole from Rousseau? He and Shannon team up to translate some of those notes, even though Shannon took French in, what, high school, right?
Well, and she dated a guy from Saint-Tropez.
Oh, she dated. Yeah, we learned that at the end of this episode. Some other stuff happens that feels sort of tangential to the main sort of Kate Sawyer Jack story. Michael teaches Sawyer about impact velocity, which is fascinating. Also, Hurley and Michael seem very familiar with what a Halliburton case is, and
I'm like, okay, Hurley, well, okay, actually, that's a storm thought. I'll hold on to that.
Rose, noticing that Charlie is still in a state of shock after the Claire thing, gives him some helpful doses of truth, and Rose is great. Elsewhere, Kate and Jack dig up a dead body, which I feel like we should not gloss over in any way. They dig up a dead body, and it's gross. This episode gets away with a lot of gross stuff. And then Jack, needing the case to go with the key that they got from the dead body, gives Sawyer a sternly worded monologue, gets the key from Sawyer. Then Jack and Kate open the case, finding four guns, some ammo, and a toy airplane that belonged to, and I can't stress this enough, to a man that Kate murdered.
Loved!
And murdered.
Murdered.
Loved.
Murdered.
Loved.
In flashbacks, we see Kate as part of the stealth brigade of a bank robbing crew in New Mexico. Also, I just like to stop for a moment and say that the coffee table book she describes of like old movie theaters in small towns, I want to write that book.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's one of my most 2004 candidates. We'll circle back
nice.
To that.
Yeah.
Later, when she turns on her bank gang, we also learn that Kate is basically Jason Bourne. Fun fact, Jason Bourne was around in 2004 as well. The whole thing ends with Shannon singing Charles Tennant's La Mer and Rose flexing some serious confidence about the fate of her husband, Bernard. And of course, Charlie has an emotional breakthrough and asks for help. As to who will help Charlie, we'll find out. But that's what happened in whatever the case may be. It's a very busy episode.
It is a very busy episode. This is the episode that when I try to talk about writing television in different types of stories, I think it's really helpful to look at the structure of it, because you can kind of break it down into A stories, B stories, C story, and then like a fun little D story. For those of you that are not familiar with that terminology, the A story would be the primary story that takes up the most of your time. And then usually the B story would be the one that takes second amount of time. Usually the A story, the B story are island stories, and then the C story is your flashback story. Sometimes there's more time spent in flashback, as I think was the case last week, if you count just chasing after Ethan, Jack, and Claire, and Charlie as the A story, and don't split up necessarily Locke and Boone until they actually split off. Wherever the case may be, keeps most of our action on the island, because I think the reveals in the flashback are really well paced. That being said, I think we're falling into a little bit of a rhythm, where we're back to island problems after some teases, last week about, maybe some more, mysterious things. As Joanna brought up, Ethan seems to prove that there are others. That want people, you know, that want to harm us, as Charlie brings up in this episode. And Charlie also reminds us there's something in the jungle knocking down trees and eating people. And so that's all bad. And we know that Boone and Locke are doing something in the jungle, but everybody else is just basically concerned with a mysterious rise in the tide that was actually caused by production having to vacate the first beach camp and move to the second beach camp.
I knew it. I was like, when I was watching this episode, I was like, they just needed to go to a different location. Saeed's like, this tide ain't normal. I'm like, or they needed a new beach. Or, yeah.
This also marks the episode that J.J. Abrams left in like a participating active showrunner capacity, writer's room, etc., because he had to go work on Mission Impossible 3 and stick something up Carrie Russell's nose, and didn't have time to necessarily spend a lot of time on the island.
That sounds so terrible if you've not seen Mission Impossible 3. That's one of the worst
Correct that error.
That's one of the worst out of context descriptions I've ever heard.
It's the one with Philip Seymour Hoffman. That's how I remember it.
The one with something up Carrie Russell's nose.
Important.
White Rabbit. All right. Yes. Can I talk about the swimming scene?
Yes.
You could talk about the let's talk about the swimming scene.
I mean, I guess we can just talk about like Sawyer and Kate in general. Like basically, like I got some feedback from listeners that even though we all paused and was like, whoa, Kate and Sawyer had a really good kiss a couple episodes ago, our listeners felt like we didn't really fully appreciate it. I will just say that the writers definitely noticed, because they're like, ooh, what if we just have Evangeline Lilly and Josh Holloway just like tumble all over each other for an episode? That sounds fun. This is an especially sweaty episode. People are very sweaty in this episode.
Because they're always running through the jungle.
Just running and tumbling and tussling. So there's like a couple tumbling and tussling and headbutting and legs wrapped around bodies and stuff like that. And you can decide for yourself what feels sexual and what feels transgressive. But in this swimming scene, I have a few notes. Number one, why is Sawyer swimming in his jeans? Like, not that he needs to be naked. Maybe it was like naked or jeans, and then I would take jeans, but aren't jeans like the most uncomfortable thing to swim in when he was swimming? So why is Sawyer swimming in his jeans? Number two, I love this sequence because they're just like splashy, splashy, fun, oasis, splashy, splashy, swim through, oh shit, dead bodies. Like, that's a really good reveal of, oh yeah, we're on a beautiful island. Oh shit, bad death things happen.
Yeah, it's here. One of the better, at least so far, that we've seen cold opens, which, these are cold opens, right? Because they come before the credits or the title.
That's all I want to say about the swimming scene. It's very sexy, and then it's very disgusting. Because then you're like, ew, dead people water. We've been swimming in dead people water. Let's go down to scavenge. You know.
Yeah, and it's interesting too that this episode does a lot of work of differentiating the tone of the way Jack and Sawyer interact in this episode, or the way that Kate and Sawyer interact, and versus the way Kate and Jack interact, which is like the Kate and Jack thing is like really sort of like an intense trust thing where they're like having a very serious conversation about whether they trust each other. And then, as I said earlier, the Sawyer thing is more of a flirt fighting through the episode thing.
But it's both of them, but it's both of these guys who, like, you know, want to be with Kate, trying to, like, you know, crack open the metaphorical case and find, like, what's really inside. And I kind of hate how both of them go about it, but being honest. Right.
Well, they both treat Kate as if she's nefariously manipulating them.
Which she, like, they just, she is manipulating them. I mean, she's manipulating them, but it's just sort of like, or what if you just let her open the fucking case in private? What if you just let her have the case?
Yeah, like, what's the harm in
that? And not need to know what's inside of it. I don't know.
Because they're obsessed with the mystery box, just like J.J. Abrams.
I guess.
Whose last episode is this one.
Do you have any thoughts? Yeah, a literal mystery box episode. Dave, do you have any thoughts about, like, Jack and Sawyer and the way that they treat Kate and their, like, need to know, their entitlement to know what's inside this case?
I think both of the entitlements are bad. I think Kate kind of accidentally, not to say that she should know, but if anybody knows on this island at this point that once you get Jack involved, you can't get him uninvolved, then Kate kind of does. So her being like, there are guns in this case that Sawyer has, yeah, she needs Jack's help, but that also means that Jack, being the person that he is, he's not going to not be the one to open the case. Does he need to, you know, be there while she takes a little plane out of the envelope? Probably not. That's Jack's dickishness that had him, you know, say that he needed, Kate needed to tell him something real last episode. But I want to roll back to the swimming because I have a very rare thing here in my notes, which is a question from Java, who does not listen to the podcast.
Hi, Java.
But who watches the episodes.
Yeah,
I know. As they're swimming, she says, what's happening with periods and body hair on this island?
Yeah, it's a great question. Yeah, because Kate is wearing like a little string bikini sort of undie situation. The magic, just as the island cured Locke of his inability to walk, it gave the women like permanent electrolysis and permanent plucked eyebrows. I mean, I didn't think about the body hair on Kate. I hope that doesn't sound weird, but I did think about it when Shannon went to sit down next to Saeed at the end and the firelight is gleaming off her like glossily waxed legs. And I was like, I mean, if they haven't been on the, you know, Shannon's the type who would wax. They haven't been on the island that long.
I was going to say, you don't think Shannon or at least found a razor somewhere?
No, wait. I was going to say that. Like Shannon, yeah, like Shannon's the type who's waxed. They haven't been on the island that long. So maybe Shannon's hair hasn't even grown back in yet. Or if they did, she would be the type to like take the time to go shave them every single day.
We do find her sunbathing at one point in this episode.
But still I was like, over time, I mean, there's a whole lot of grooming questions. Like, wouldn't all the guys have beards, like, fairly quickly? Wouldn't all the women have terrible, greasy hair? I mean, this is why on The Real Survivor, they give everyone bandanas. Because they're like, if you want to put a bandana over your greasy, disgusting hair,
that'd be fine.
You go ahead and do that. Make yourself camera ready with this bandana. On the island, however, they seem to have cracked the, I mean, they've got luggage to go through, I guess, but they all have shampooed hair, you know, every day. So, yeah, it's a good question from Java. The answer is it's a broader question that the show is not interested in addressing.
Correct. It is the miracle of not cable television in 2004 and maybe a magical island that could, you know, make people walk. Why not make all their hair suck?
Island magic is a good yada yada yada.
Maybe
for a lot of stuff on Lost. Yada, yada,
maybe yada, when Sun was foraging aspirin, she also foraged you know, like some natural wax for the ladies to take care of their body hair. It's a thing.
All I would say, that would be an amazing, you know, C story coming up here on an episode of Lost.
It should. The women go sugaring. Sugaring is a way to remove body hair. Yeah, they should have.
Yes. But I think that to go back to what you were talking about, it is really weird how both the men treat Kate, and I would almost say it crosses into like wildly inappropriate.
Absolutely.
Except the episode, I don't think, thinks that too much, because it spends every time it can bouncing back to show us how untrustworthy Kate is until the very end. So of our flashbacks, only the very first one and the very last one could be viewed, I think, as even remotely Kate positive. Otherwise, she's putting people in danger. She's selling out perfectly nice bank managers. She's conning criminals and then shooting everybody.
No, but isn't it
when she runs out of options?
Isn't it good that she's conning criminals, first of all? Secondly, it's the same thing that happened in her first flashback episode. She saves the cat. She saves the bank manager. So we know she's not really bad. She's like, you said no one would get hurt. That was the point of this job. So like, no one gets hurt.
Well, I think the thing that we learn about Kate in this episode is that she is of, at least in her past, at least in the stories that they're telling us about her past, she has this sort of alternate or this singular purpose that is unknown to the people around her, and that it's all kind of selfish. Yep, that's it.
Just yeah, kind of I mean, it's hard for me to argue with that, but at the same time, I'm just like, let the girl open the. I mean, like,
right? The stuff that happens on the island feels unfair to Kate because they are not seeing the flashbacks.
Jack is such an asshole. Like, yes, she lies to him over and over again. True, but like, he feels so why is he entitled to the truth when he doesn't like share the truth with everyone on the island? Why is he entitled to know everything when he like specifically talks about keeping information from other people?
Well, I think he's misreading his relationship with Kate.
Ugh.
Yeah.
And then she's weeping. She gives her, he's like, here, is this what you wanted? She has the plane. She starts weeping. Yeah, sure. She confesses to murder. And then he just walks out of that fucking cave. He's just like, doo doo doo. Well, I'll pack up these guns and I'm gone. Like,
but he kind of looks back at her at the end.
Oh, great. Good job. Good job, bud.
No, I'm not the right person to be on the podcast defending Jack in this episode.
Like, oh, yeah, Sawyer, I was rewatching this episode, which I've seen many times. I'm rewatching and I'm like, wow, Sawyer's like kind of a real piece of shit in this episode. Then I was like, and then Jack's like, hold my non-existent beer. Hold my tropical fruit drink. I'm going to show you, like, it's worse. I think what Jack does is worse. They're both bad. Right. And Jack's style of it is worse because it's so, like, Sawyer's like, come on, girl, you're down in the dirt with me. Just stay down here in the dirt with me. It's fine.
Sawyer's feels consistent with his character, Jack, where you know that Sawyer's just going to poke.
Yeah.
You know?
And Jack is so self-righteous. He's so fucking self-righteous. And just like,
well,
don't, Kate, just don't. And I'm like, come on, bud. Like, I don't know.
The only reason that the episode like gives us for that explanation, which is not a way of defending Jack whatsoever, but that's the reason the marshal's involved in all and like this whole case situation, is because it's supposed to remind us that the last time Jack tried to like help out Kate, he ended up having to like kill somebody, and that's why he didn't burn them with the Fuchsia Lodge. And we have that line where Jack said, I had to bury them. It's supposed to remind us that Jack's still raw from the previous Kate episode. But you know, it doesn't work because we're working in broadcast time, not on island time.
Well, it's a twofer, right? It's like, that's true, but also the marshal's location needed to be information only Jack knew, so that there was a reason that Kate had to go to Jack to get to the marshal to get to the key. Do you know what I mean? It's a logistics thing. They needed to have a story. Like, because before then, like, we didn't know what happened to the marshal's body. We never saw Jack, like, dig that grave, you know? But so we had to have this line where Kate's like, why'd you bury him all the way over here in this secret location that I then had to go to you to find out where he was? Jack's like, because I had to be the one to bury him.
Also, because the writers knew I needed to be involved.
I don't always hate Jack, and I don't always, like, and I don't hate him. No, I kind of hate him in this episode. I don't always hate Jack, but, like, this is just not a good Jack look, this whole episode. And not that Kate looks great, but, like, Kate, at least, like, she has a really emotionally profound reason why it's, like, her you know, it's like Jack's daddy issues. Like, this is her issue. This is her, like, root issue. We don't know all the information about it, but, like, we do know that by the end when she's, like, racked with sobs and stuff like that, it's the equivalent of Jack, like, helplessly chasing his dad's ghost through the jungle. And so, like, so then we have to have sympathy for her for that, because this is, like, her deepest, darkest thing. Or it's, like, Sawyer doing his worst around his letter. So you have to, or the show wants you to have sympathy for whoever the core character is, because this is them, their worst, like, deepest, whatever it may be, whatever the case may be. But Jack doesn't have that excuse. Like, what entitlement does he have to, like, know Kate's secrets? Like, why? You know what I mean? I don't know.
Right. He doesn't. Yeah. Well, you know, it's part of the show liking keeping Jack and Sawyer and Kate in a weird triangle, which Absolutely. Is a thing. Because otherwise, you're right. Like, Jack doesn't do this to Locke. Jack doesn't do this to Saeed. You know, he doesn't need to know everything about Hurley.
Right.
Stuff like that.
He has this, like, weird ownership thing with her. And Sawyer does too, to a certain extent. And there are definitely, I just want to be fair to all sides, there are ways in which Kate knows that and manipulates that. That's also true. It's like it's a toxic little thing, but, like, there's just something about, like, something weirdly off-puttingly paternalistic about the way that Jack deals with Kate often, and in this episode specifically, that puts me on edge. I can't wait to hear what Lindsay says about that. I don't know what Lindsay thinks, honestly, so I can't wait to hear what she says about that. Do we want to, like, before we get to other things, do we want to, like, veer lighter, because you didn't know that Joanna was going to get so agitated about this, to, like, should we, like, throw in what the most 2004 thing is here?
Well, no. I mean, there's a lot of other stuff that, like, happens in the episode.
No.
We necessarily need to get at Oh, go ahead.
I didn't mean, like, to finish talking in the calm. I just meant to, like, quickly lighten the mood.
I mean, we can if you want. We could do most 2004 things.
All right, let's do it really quickly, and then we'll talk about other calm things. I've got a few options. I've got the seatbelt strap on Kate's bag. I don't know if you remember this. This is an early aughts thing that, like, messenger bags would have a seatbelt buckle, as the strap. It's a fun airplane thing, but it's also just, like, an early 2000s thing. A coffee table book photographs of old theaters in small towns. That's not how the publishing industry works anymore. That's a 2004 thing. Shannon references Finding Nemo, which is a 2003 film. So there's that. And then I'm just going to bring it back to Blue Stripe Rugby Shirt Girl. She's in the episode. She's no longer wearing her iconic blue stripe. She has switched to a brown button down sleeveless shirt, but the midriff is still happening. So she's like, no matter what, the bottom of my shirt will not touch the top of my pants. This is my 2004 mission. Should I choose to accept it? So is it?
Oh.
The return of
Midriff
Girl.
We should also mention that we're putting this up as a poll on Twitter.
Yes, this is a new thing. So, Return of Midriff Girl, Finding Nemo, the coffee table book, or the seatbelt buckle on Kate's bag. Let us start with Dave. What's the most 2004 thing?
Seatbelt buckle.
Seatbelt buckle.
Just from personal experience.
Yeah, it reminds me of, like, bike messengers. You know what I mean? Neil.
I think it might be Midriff Girl.
Yeah.
You just don't see a lot of midriff work these days.
You don't
well,
see enough.
Not in that way.
Yeah. You really don't see
There's
enough.
There's a very specific.
I just really like that she kept that aesthetic. She's like, okay, the rugby shirt's getting a little stanky. Who needs long sleeves on this island? I'm going to go sleeveless, but don't worry. I didn't get these abs for fucking nothing, so you'll still be seeing them. Yeah.
This is an episode in which most of the cast gets a wardrobe change.
Yes,
according
that's
to
correct.
The I was reading that in the Lostopedia earlier, where it's like, this is like a big cut. Was this, did they do the mid-season breaks at this point with Lost? Was this one of those mid-season ones?
I don't know. I know this is the highest rated episode of season one, and it is, like we were saying, sort of the beginning of the back half of the season. But I don't know. We are already into a mid-season break. I think we might have still been week to week. I could Google that real fast while we're discuss another island happening.
I will talk about the fashion then. I will just say that these are two of my favorite Kate looks because I love that deep purple tank top, which I think we have seen before. But like then she switches to my favorite Kate shirt ever, which is the sleeveless high neck black, high V black shirt. You don't see enough like high neck V sort of. It's an unusual neckline. Looks great. She's fantastic.
Her hair really has multiple different modes in this episode. Great. Kate's hair. Always important.
The post grave digging, like deeply sweaty ponytail is definitely a look.
Right. And she has like a slightly more casual version of it when she's like up in the tree picking fruit.
Yes. A lot of sweaty, curly Kate in this episode for sure.
I'm glad you guys vamped because Neil, you are correct.
Yes. I couldn't remember when they started that. I didn't.
I mean, I don't think this is mid-season break, like full mid-season break, but this is holiday break so All the Best Cowboys Have Daddy Issues aired on December 8th, 2004. Then Lost went into reruns until January 5th, 2005 for whatever the case may be.
I meant to double check that. I'm sorry. So that should have all been the most 2005 thing about this episode. So my apologies. Next time we will make sure.
Well, no, here's the question. Here's the question, Joanna.
Whatever the question may be, Dave.
Whatever the question may be. We've already spent several television broadcast months on the island, but they've only spent several weeks on the island. They are firmly still in 2004 and will be for quite some time. Are we going to be voting on island things or specifically on production design things?
What a great question. I just don't know how much the show attempted to keep itself a 2004 period piece, other than like I can think of a few things, but like I don't think it's really, we'll see.
If you wanted to stick with most 2004 thing until the end of season one, I think you would definitely be justified in doing that.
I'll think about this interesting wrinkle that you've thrown into the proceedings.
Island time or broadcast time? Which one?
I'm definitely not ready to talk about island time.
Not ready to talk about island time.
Yeah.
All right, back to the episode then. Is it just me being a Lutheran who isn't anymore, or is Rose giving like kind of too hard of a sell to a guy who's super depressed? That Jesus is the way out.
I would have said that. And I'm usually like, because I was raised atheist, I'm usually like very knee jerk, no reaction to people sort of being like, this is the answer is Jesus. Except Charlie's a Catholic. Like Charlie is religious. So like I was thinking that at first. I was like, okay, Rose. And then I was like, oh yeah, this is Charlie's like help language. I don't know if Rose knows that.
Oh, I like that.
I don't know if Rose knows that. I hope she does, but because otherwise I do think that's a little pushy in a way that I don't like. But then I really loved it. Like once I thought about it that way, like I'm like, yeah, this is something that Charlie needs. This is something that he's used to in his life. And like, it is, I think, important to show religion and faith, not just, sort of faith in island magic, but like specific religious faith as a way that people would cope in disaster situations, you know?
I definitely agree with religious faith, and I love her. There's a thin line between faith and delusion. It's much better on my sideline. I like that. It's when you're actually talking about specific types of faith, like cutting from I'm not the one who could help you to the cross that Jack put on the grave, which has to be the only reason there's a cross on the fucking grave.
That's so silly. Sorry.
Where I'm like, come on, guys. And this episode is really trying to stitch together all its different plots by doing these little throws, but it's not as super successful as it has been in the past, you know, going off of clinking ice or Jack looking down at a leaf, because it does things like Michael saying, use the axe, and then we learn immediately that Boone has taken the axe for the secret thing down in the caves, or it has the cut from Rose talking to Charlie over to the cross. It has more the stories pushing our conclusions in a different direction through montage than through action of the characters, I think, in this episode.
I have a question. the cross thing, like cutting right to the cross, to me feels like a studio note. Like, it feels like the dumbest studio note of all time, but it's like Damon Lindelof being like, I'm doing this show and I'm like trying to deconstruct what like faith is all about, man. And the network's like, yeah, but people aren't going to get that. You got to put a cross in there.
That's just a thing
that I always think of with like the ones that are like really on the nose. I'm like, that feels like a network note.
Well, I do like, the headcanon that we can't prove wrong that we came up with, where just Rose recognizes that that's what Charlie needs, because I don't think, at least up until now, we've had any indication, that Rose is super religious, but she is very empathic, as we learned sort of with Jack.
Well, you can imagine a scenario in which the writer's room is like, okay, we need to figure out how we're going to get Charlie out of his funk,
right,
or out of this shock state. And who's a character that could talk to Charlie about religion who we haven't checked in with in a while? And it's Rose.
It's not going to be Shannon.
Frankly, I really love this whole thing because it's just, I feel like, and I don't think this is spoilers to say, this is not the first time that someone has given Charlie work as distraction from his like head demons, and it won't be the last. And it really is, I think, the best, it is the healthiest thing for Charlie to ever do, is to have something to do. And so Rose is like, help me move this shit off the beach. Even before, you know, before she gives him the hard sell about Jesus, she's like, keep yourself, don't just sit here. Cause she, and she's recognizing like herself. Remember when she was like sitting isolated from everyone thinking about Bernard at the beginning of the season? And Jack sort of like tried to fold her back into the community. She's like, get up, help me move this stuff. You're not the only one who's hurting, you know, like compassion. It's not your fault, compassion, but also, okay, let's bootstrap ourselves and move on with our lives. Not like move on, forget about Claire, but just sort of like, you can't just sit here and cry. And I really love that. And I love Dominic Monaghan in this episode. Just like the amount of crying Charlie that we get feels like, I don't know, there's sometimes when the Charlie character veers into a place of self-pity that I can't follow him, and this is not one of those cases. I think this is just, like, really beautifully done. So I really love the Rose and Charlie stuff.
Yeah, I think it's a really great example of just the survival stuff that we talk about.
Yeah.
You know, it's like back to island business, and some of the island business right now is Charlie's in a lot of pain over the Claire thing, and somebody needed to help him.
Speaking of island,
I forgot my other 2004 thing, but it's too late, but that's okay. I'm just going to say it, which is that, when do you think Halliburton switched from a word we associate the most with cases to a word we associate with like Dick Cheney and nefarious deeds? Cause I was looking at the Wikipedia for Halliburton, and I think it's like, 2006, honestly. Like, 2002, if you're really paying attention, 2002 is like when you, probably if you're really, really paying attention, it goes back before that. But like, if you're paying attention and politically engaged, 2002 is probably when you start really like noticing Halliburton. But I think it becomes part of like the general vocabulary. And maybe for our younger audiences, this was an aughts thing that we talked about Halliburton, which was like, no bid contracts in the Iraq war, and maybe why we were over there in the first place and all this sort of stuff like that. And I was just thinking, like, if you heard Halliburton, which is, you know, is the name of the case company, a famous case company or whatever, you heard it in 2004/2005, would you think of the Cheney organization, or would you only think of the case, whatever the case may be? I don't know. Because it's more of a 2004 question.
Well, I think it is interesting because, like, it is one of those company names that, having been a young budding adult during those times, like, now to me is like nails on a chalkboard. Like, oh my God, Evil Corporation. Like,
yeah,
that's
exactly
one of the great evil corporation names of all human history to me. But if you do think about it, yeah, when this was written, when this aired, it was really before it became part of the pop culture that Halliburton was bad. It was just another company, right? I guess at that point.
Yeah. That
was my question.
Yeah.
Like, well, yeah, watching it at the time, you don't even think about it. I've always thought it's weird even the first time I watched it, that both Michael and Hurley were like, yeah, we know all about those. But yeah, it's weird now. And that's a good way to explain it for people who might be a little younger.
We'll talk
why is this a thing that's okay? It was okay back then, I guess.
We'll talk about the Hurley thing in the storm, I guess. But like the Michael thing, I don't know. It makes sense to me. Like as a
construction guy,
he would know like things that are hard to break into. I don't know why. That just sort of makes sense to me. I do
the
love the
velocity thing is great.
I do love the montage of her, of Sawyer trying to open that case. So it's pretty good. Pretty good.
And I do love the irony of like Kate's thing is climbing trees, and the thing that ends that Sawyer almost loses the case over is when he tries to climb a tree.
I mean, love Kate like spider monkeying. Like she notices him following her, because I don't know if you guys know this, but she's a tracker. She notices him following her. But she's just like stealth puma out of nowhere, like grabs the case and sprints away. It's great. And I love the shots of them both running through the jungle. It's great too. I was just looking it up. I couldn't remember if next week's is the Michael and Walt episode, but no, of course it's the Boone episode. Should we talk about the Sibs in this episode?
Boone and Shannon.
I don't think we need to cover Boone and Locke beyond really what I said, and that they've been doing something in the jungle for 4 days because...
And Boone smuggled the axe out there.
Smuggled the axe out there. We'll be dealing with Boone more next week because we get a
He does stop to remind Shannon that she's worthless.
I think we don't have to talk only have to talk about
They're not do you want to beep that? I don't know. I almost decided not to. So let's beep all of this.
You don't have to elaborate after.
I know.
We could just beep it.
I just thought I would share where I am. Okay, I'm sorry. Yeah, Boone's really shitty tearing down of Shannon. And then also him, like, creepily looking at Shannon talking to Saeed. It's also some fun stuff from Boone. But we should talk about the Saeed and Shannon stuff, right? Like that?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Okay. I think Shannon's development here is the most interesting, because although Saeed's flirting is
weird,
I think mostly a motivation to get stuff out of Shannon, which is fine. And Shannon is sort of reciprocating for one scene, which is, you know, fine. I'm not going to judge consensual flirting.
Is it that Saeed's trying to speak to her in a language that he thinks Shannon will listen to, which is like flirty?
He's a torturer, but he knows how to extract information. And he's like, what's the way to extract information out of this person? Even though, like, it's information that's locked in her head somewhere, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so he's like, I believe in you. Boone's like, you're worthless. Saeed's like, that's not the way. I believe in you.
Another reminder that Saeed is a master manipulator.
That's what I'm saying. Like, yeah, he's cating her, right? And so he's like, I believe in you. I believe in you. But then also he does this, you know, that, gif here, another episode of Joanna Describes Gifts. You know, that gif from the Little Rascals, actually someone used it on Twitter this week in a response to a photo of you two, but like, from the Little Rascals where it's like this little kid just like, placing his chin in his hands and like gazing adoringly at something. Anyway, at one point, Saeed, like sort of bemused, but also flirtatiously, like puts his hand on his chin on his hand. He's like, you know, a guy you knew in Saint-Tropez, tell me more. It's like such a weird moment.
Saeed, such a softy.
What are you
after
doing?
After all the torture.
Yeah, it's like funny and cute, but also like weird. But I'll chuck it up to like, I mean, Shannon's a lovely looking lady, so who would want to flirt with her? But also, trying to extract intel the best way he can, and it's honey, not vinegar, with Shannon. That's what works. So,
mm-hmm. You don't think he's actually attracted to Shannon?
No, both. I said that first.
No, both.
Both things.
Yeah, fair, Boone's giant bucket of vinegar did not work.
Guess what, Shannon? You're worthless.
You're worthless.
Also, reading a paper magazine is a very 2004 thing to do. Yeah. So math and lyrics to Beyond the Sea. I mean, this is when if we weren't already know what the rest of the show is about, we would be like, this is like a primo entry for like a conspiracy theory wall. I'd start putting the lyrics to Lemaire on the wall and some math equations and like, you know, isn't this the beginning of some fun mystery box shit, Dave? How do you feel about
Rousseau it's like papers? A sea of sparkles and all these different lyric things. And I'm like, we don't know that for sure the island and the song are unrelated just because Shannon remembers it from Finding Nemo. But yeah, I'm super excited that we have cryptic maps.
Yes.
They're the type of easy open plot device that all it needs to happen is Said needs to be like, I've been looking at these equations again. And then you just unlock whatever we need to know about. Where's Danielle? What are the song lyrics about? What's the map actually of? Is there actually some longitude and latitude in there?
Yeah. And the suggestion is, which I think raises an interesting question, is that like the way Shannon tells her story is the kid watched the movie over and over and over again and then would write the lyrics. So like what experience did Rousseau have that was that indelible on her? In these intervening, what was it, 16 years? And why did she write those lyrics? The numbers are interesting. You know, the numbers could be whatever, but the lyrics are like always really were more fascinating to me because it's like they have to mean something, right? Does everything mean something? Everything has to mean something. This is Lost. That's how it works.
We know Rousseau is like a scientist of some type, but then we also have Said, who has been like jerry-rigging like I don't know a whole bunch of electronics together.
I think you mean like
3-point.
I think you mean triangulating the transmission.
Yes, those things.
That's my best attempt at Naveen Andrews' not accurate accent. I'm not trying to do an accurate accent, just so you guys know.
what sort of mask could this possibly be? Where 16-year-old math equations. Well, I guess it's not math. It's not like math ages that fast where you'd be like, oh, I've never seen this equation before.
It might be more like you need to know what the equation is about. It's not like he doesn't understand what the equations are, but it's almost like he was saying longitude, latitude. Like you need an orienting sort of piece of intel to even understand what the equations could be referring to. Do you know?
I would say it's either that or it's working with a system of variables that would be like consistent across a different method of discipline. So like you're using like a different Latin letter to make up a constant. You don't have like the way of he doesn't have the constant in order to unravel the actual equation of variables.
It's like if spoilers for Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. It's like if you were trying to do the trials on the way to the Grail without the notebook, right?
Or if you were trying to build a staff using only one side
right.
of the medallion.
Exactly. They're digging in the wrong spot. So like, you know, you need, it's intel you need. He thinks like maybe these lyrics are code for what he needs in order to apply the maths. So, that if, you know, whatever the case may be, we would have to discuss in the storm.
Ooh, that sounds like a lead into the storm, which we will get to. Right after, what's coming up now, Joanna?
Our conversation with Lindsay Romaine of Nerdist fame.
Let's do it.
We are thrilled to have on the podcast a friend of the pod, staff writer at Nerdist, Lindsay Romaine. Hello, Lindsay. How are you?
Hello. I'm doing pretty good. A little tired from Con of Thrones still, but hanging in.
Yeah. This to clarify, we are speaking just a few days after we all attended the Con of Thrones convention. This podcast will come out a week later, so I just don't want you guys to think that Lindsay has been under the weather for over a week. So, yeah. So we are here to talk not about Game of Thrones, unfortunately, but we're here to talk about Kate, who is Lindsay's surprise favorite character. Is not a popular pick, actually, despite the fact that she is like a co-lead on the show. Do you want to kick off by, I made our friend Kim Renfro do this too. Defend your case, Lindsay. Why is Kate your favorite character?
Yeah, well, I think it's I mean, she's a character, obviously, like you said, the co-lead. So I think I just took to her instantly because of that, because there's so much exposure to her. She's a character that's very layered. And I think that slowly starts to reveal itself more and more as the show goes along. At this point, this is what, her second episode. So we're really just sort of starting to learn who Kate is, but I really love Evangeline Lilly. I think she just has this sort of beautiful openness to the way that she acts that really draws me in. And I love Kate for being sort of just this scrappy little survivor. I don't think, you know, she really just on the island, she's immediately useful. Some people would argue that she's not, but I think she's immediately useful. She's immediately helpful. She's warm. She's kind of like the island mother in a way. And I love all of the different, again, layers that she has.
I love that you see her as an island mother. I've never considered it that way. I'll have to like think about it like that. But I mean, to your point of her being useful, I mean, she starts this episode, you know, up a tree picking fruit. Like she is just like, you cannot argue with the fact that she's useful. She tracks, she forages for food. She tries to find, you know, solutions in a leadership capacity. Like she is one of the alpha useful people on the island. That's just like, she's very capable, right?
You know? Yeah. And I think that's why I see her as sort of the mother. Like she's always providing for people, you know, like you said, she's gathering fruit at the beginning of this. She's constantly taking in people's concerns. She worries about Saeed when he's gone for a while. Like I think she's just always constantly worried about how everyone is doing in a way, way more so than I think anyone else really is.
That's okay. So then this episode is a test of your Kate feelings, because this is an episode that I think embodies a lot of what people find frustrating about Kate, which is, it doesn't have a lot of the indecisiveness that I think people find frustrating Kate, but it does have this sort of like, hi, Sawyer, I know you're interested in me, or hi, Jack, I know you're interested in me, both of them. So I'm going to use that to get something I need from you. Do you have any thoughts about that? Do you feel like that's a mischaracterization? What do you think?
No, I think you're exactly right. Actually, the word that I wrote down when I was rewatching this episode is that Kate's very extra. She really like goes extremely out of her way sometimes to get the things that she wants, that it, you know, it's like there could be a really much easier way to do this, or it seems like there could be. I think it's hard to talk about her so much without some spoilers, and I won't do that, obviously. But I do think a lot of like the things that I grew to love about Kate aren't fully made available yet. But I do think that a lot of that extraness starts to make sense to me a little bit more in this episode, and you know, later also.
So, and what would you say, maybe try your best to be non-spoiler, I know it's really tough, but like, what would you say about people who are already, we're only, you know, like halfway through the first season, but who are already tired of the Jack Sawyer Kate, like, love triangle dynamic, which is something that the show, really loves, especially up to this point. What are your feelings around that? And what would you say to people who are sort of like cautiously wary about it?
Yeah, I think, I mean, again, no spoilers, but I do think it's made clear even in the few episodes that we have had where we had some insight into her mind, is that she does have a complicated relationship with men. You know, we see it in the Marshall, and we see it just sort of in her daily interactions with them. I think that, again, like, as we learn more about her, some of that becomes clear, whatever, but I think you can draw just from her early interactions that, yeah, there's a fraught relationship that she has specifically with men. She even hints at it in this episode, you know, when she says that it belonged to the man I loved, it belonged to the man I killed. You know, what does that mean?
Right.
And, yeah.
Right. What does it mean? Right. Yeah.
Yeah. What does that mean? But I think you can, that line alone sort of symbolizes just the weird nature that she seems to have with these men in her life. I do think that she manipulates them a lot to get what she wants, but I don't think it's necessarily intentional. I don't think she's like, oh, how can I use Jack to do this? I think it is a little bit, but I don't think that she's trying to be hurtful or anything. I think it's just in her nature to do that because of life circumstances.
Do you find, are there other characters, you know, when I was talking to Kim about Jack, she pointed out the fact that, like, she loves Jack and she loves Jon Snow, and so she identified a character archetype that she personally responds to in stories. Is there, like, an archetype, you know, that Kate fills out for you, or are there other characters, fictional characters that you've responded to that you feel, like, correlate to what Kate is doing on this island?
Yeah, definitely. And I didn't even realize this connection until recently, but Kate really reminds me of Rey in Star Wars.
I knew you were going to say that, but I don't see it at all. So, like, tell me all about it. Tell me.
Yeah, no, I think I don't think it's directly, like, apparent. Maybe it's just me reading into it and knowing that JJ, like, created them both. But I do think, you know, they're both sort of scrappy survivors. They both have freckles. no, but, like, outside of just the way that they look, they I do think that there's sort of like, survival instinct in both of them. They're both kind of, you know, we see them on sandy places where they have to learn to take care of themselves. And they both seem very open-hearted to all of the people around them. There's a lonely quality to them, too, that I think, you know, Kate's loneliness is something that I really latched onto right away. I don't think that she knows how to create relationships, healthy relationships with people around her, but she tries. And I see that a little bit with Rey also, you know, the second that she meets Finn, there's just an immediate, like, she takes to him right away, latching on sometimes, yeah, in unhealthy ways. Not that the Rey and Finn is unhealthy, but just immediately attaching yourselves to people regardless of what they might bring to the table. So, yeah, I've definitely seen a little bit of that in both of those characters.
Yeah, I guess I think the difference I would see is I think of Rey, and this doesn't negate this great article you wrote about the horniness of The Last Jedi, but I see Rey as, like, very sexually innocent, and I don't see Kate that way, you know what I mean? So I don't see Rey at all weaponizing the attraction that other people have to her advantage, but that is something that Kate does. And I don't necessarily judge her for it, because, you know, let's use all of our weapons in our arsenal. I think where I get most irritated is not necessarily anything that Kate herself does. There's some stuff in this episode, but largely I like Kate. I don't get irritated with stuff that Kate does. I get irritated when sometimes the show or the male characters on the show treat her like she's the, you know, shiniest apple that ever existed on the tree. You know what I mean? It's just sort of like, especially in the early in this season, when it seemed at one point that, like, Charlie and Saeed and Jack and Sawyer were all, like, after Kate. And, like, when you winnow it down to Jack and Sawyer, that's a dynamic that I can handle a little bit better than, like, everybody, like, is after Kate, you know? I'm like, Maggie Grace is right there. She looks great. Come on. She's not tanning for herself, guys. So pay attention. But
yeah. No, I think that's definitely a fair criticism. I do think that that's the product of having, like, a mostly male writer's room and, some of the things that happen. I actually even, like, made a note during this episode. I was like, this is the second episode in, like, a few episodes where Kate has just, like, fully tongue-kissed some guy. Like, she's really, like, you know, really just kind of put on display as that romantic, I don't know, character that they can lean on that way. And it's not always super healthy, and it's not always super, you know, feminist. I think even Evangeline Lilly has gone back and said some things about how she felt Kate was kind of utilized in the show sometimes. So, yeah, I don't know if I hold that against her. I definitely do hold it against the creators sometimes, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, there's stuff like in the pilot, there's that opening shot of her, like, in her underwear in the surf, and it's just like the way the camera lingers on her. And then, like, I've talked about this before, the show gets better at being, like, sort of equal opportunity leering. We get some nice, like, Sawyer torso in this episode and stuff like that. It's just, like, I think the way that it initially leans into that, it takes a little bit of time to lean back away from that. So yeah, and I will be interested to chase down some of those things that Evangeline Lilly might have said about the way that Kate was treated. But my bigger complaint, and you know, if listeners have gotten this far in the episode, they've already heard me complain about it, are Sawyer and Jack in this episode. I have a lot of issues with their, what I was calling their sense of entitlement, to know, what Kate's secrets are. I was wondering, that's maybe leading the witness, but I'm wondering, like, what are your thoughts, having just rewatched this episode, your Sawyer and Jack thoughts?
Yeah, absolutely. It's really interesting rewatching the show now too, because I watched it all live. I was a huge fan. I was very like involved in the fandom, and I think, I'm seeing it a little bit differently. I never really noticed the possession angles that both of them seem to have with her. Jack and Kate relationship this early on is so like problematic to me, and it's weird. I think, you know, both of them have problematic aspects, but it's a lot of Jack like being condescending to her, and kind of her vice versa. But I never really know. It seems like he's very controlling of her, especially in this episode where he's watching her. You know, he notices her slip the key away, and he notices her, you know, trying to get something out of him in terms of what's in the case. And he's very direct about it, but he still goes along with it. And so I guess I'm not really like sure what he wants out of her other than to own her.
Right.
So yeah. Yeah.
She's lying to him a certain degree. And so like, you don't want to like deal with someone who's lying to you, especially like in a survivalist situation. But it's just like, it's so self-righteous. You know what I mean? If she could just be like, hey, I need this key for this case I found. It's personal and private. Jack wouldn't have let her have that either. You know what I mean?
Right. Like, right.
He needs to know. And like the thing that I was saying when I was talking to the guys about this is like, I see in this episode, like the case is a pretty obvious metaphor for like, you know, Kate's secrets, Kate's past, and both Sawyer and Jack are desperate to get inside the case and find out, you know, like what's going on with her.
Yeah. And at this point, Jack has a little bit more information, and I think he's kind of like high on that. He's like, oh, well, I know that she's the bad girl. And
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Whereas Sawyer is like, and my take on this is like, both of them are irritating to me in this episode in various ways. But Sawyer bothers me less because it's a little bit more like, the way I see this love triangle is like, Kate has a duality, or I'll say this, there's like who Kate was and who she wants to be, right? And Jack is a good partner for who she wants to be, and Sawyer is a good partner for who she was. And so the push and pull of the island is like, can you have a tabula rasa, start a new start, be the person you want to be, or will the, you know, will those old traits just always pull you back to who you were? And like that's the pull of Sawyer on her, and the promise of Jack for her. And like, you know, not that Jack is like perfect, but like those are the dualities. And so like, I can't blame Sawyer, because Sawyer just wants her down like in the dirt with him, so that he like feels like he has, like he's not alone there, and he sees her as a kindred, and he's like, you belong down here with me. This is who we are. Does that make sense to you? Do you have a different take?
Yeah.
Like, what do you think?
Yeah, well, so I was always more of a skater, not a jader, especially back in the day, as we in the fandom used to call ourselves. That was like the divide. You either skated or jaded. I always kind of like vibed more off of Sawyer and Kate, because I do think, yeah, they're such equals. They're both on this island. They both have these kind of mysterious pasts. They're both criminals. They're both con artists, as we see with Kate in this episode. So yeah, it's definitely the island sort of testing Kate through these two men, and Sawyer is the one that's most kind of messing with her id at this point. He's the one that represents everything she hates and is trying to run away from. And yet the two of them, I feel like, especially in this episode, you know, the beginning when they're swimming in the waterfall and stuff, I think the two of them are capable of like more like having more moments of joy.
Yeah.
And like it's frustrating because you want them to just give in to that, because, you know, I think they could have more fun that way. But yeah, it is Kate really running from that and pushing from that. And it's super on display in this episode.
What do you make of the flashback narrative in this episode? What do you think it does to enhance our understanding of Kate or the on-island plot in general?
Yeah, I think, we can go off of the Sawyer stuff for that. I think it is the first time that we see that Kate has conned people in her past life, you know, and the first in Tabula Rasa, we don't have a full understanding of like what her capabilities are as a criminal. And this is like when we see that they're both kind of swindlers in that way. They both use people to get what they want, and they both, you know, have cases full of mysterious things in their past. And so I do think that the flashback to me sort of represents what we were just talking about, which is this storied past of hers and how it conflicts with the interesting relationship between the two men on this island. You know, we see her kind of manipulate a Sawyer-ish dude in her flashback. Mm-hmm. And it also sets up this intriguing question of who was this man she loved? Who was this man she, you know, killed? And what does that mean for this, these relationships and where they sit with her right now?
Yeah, it's funny. I guess something you just said made me realize again why the Sawyer approach bothers me less than the Jack approach is, like, when Sawyer sees her conning him, he, like, loves it. He's like, yes. There you go, doing your thing. You're doing your thing. I see you. I see what you're doing. It's great. It doesn't work on me. Well, it works and it doesn't on me, but, like, I see it and it's great. Jack is just, like, chiding her and admonishing her and, like, it just, like, it's so paternalistic. I don't like it at all. So,
yeah, no, I agree. This episode's also, it's really kind of like Sawyer and Kate on, like, a race to outcon one another. Yeah. I think that's, like, more fun than Jack just being a jerk to her. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, like, I love the sequence when he's, like, gone up the tree to try to break the case open and she just, like, darts in and grabs the case and runs off. It's a great little moment.
So. It's so funny.
And then, like, I want to talk to you about the Saeed Shannon stuff happening this episode too. What kind of thoughts do you have about that?
I have complicated thoughts about Shannon and Saeed. Uh-huh. I think their dynamic here, it actually kind of reminded me a little bit what you were saying of with Jack, where Saeed's just being kind of, like, mean to Shannon. He, like, asks her for help, and then she tries to help him, and he just criticizes her the whole time. So I think there's an unhealthy aspect to, like, what's going on here between the two of them. And Shannon, this is, like, around the time when I really start feeling for Shannon. I think it kind of started a little bit before, but when she's really expressing, like, I'm just trying to help you guys however I can. And she even has that line, like, you know, haven't you heard I'm worthless? And it's really heartbreaking that she's, you know, giving her all and really just being met with, like, Saeed's frustrations. So, yeah, it's complicated.
Yeah, I'm wondering we've got a lot of listeners who really do not like Shannon, and I'm wondering what Boone calling her worthless and her believing and absorbing that will do for their sympathies. You know what I mean? I think that is, like, a real turning point for Shannon. I have a lot of sympathy for Shannon. That I didn't have in 2004 that I do have for her now. So
yeah, same. Especially by the end of this episode, she does decode. You know, she does figure out what the map is saying.
Yeah.
So she does start to prove her worth here and show that she might have kind of an interesting angle that the other ones don't have. And she has this kind of wild card. You know, she has that she can speak French and no one else can, which is very important when you have a mysterious French woman on your island.
Somewhere in the jungle.
Yes.
And then do you remember, I mean, since you were original, were you, like, on LiveJournal or Tumblr?
Oh,
or,
yeah.
Yeah, all right.
I was on the Fuselage, which was, like, the message board that the show created, like, I think in, like, the first or second episode. I was, like, an OG member of that, so.
What was your commenter name? Do you remember?
My commenter name? Yes, I do remember. It was Charlie Pace 007. Not because I'm a James Bond fan, but because I graduated in 2007. So it was, like, the number I used. But yes, that was it.
Wow. That's amazing. And so, like, since you were an original viewer when it was airing, something like that, do you remember what you thought, you know, it's so hard to talk about and not spoil, but, like, what you thought when, like, Ethan first showed up, because that just happened, obviously, in the episode previous. And sort of, like, what was going on in the island at this time?
Yeah, I don't think I had a clear, like, theory at this point, but, oh my gosh, the amount of theories that were happening already this, like, short into a show. Like, I feel like with other shows, it kind of takes a while before that intense fandom shows up. And with Lost, it was, like, immediate. I remember there being theories about, like, the toy plane that Kate has at the end and if that has, like, some sort of conspiracy behind it because it's a plane, you know. I remember people immediately figuring out with Ethan, like, anagrams for his name and stuff, you know, like, just all sorts of crazy theorizing going on. I think I was, like, convinced that I don't even really remember what I was convinced of at this point. I feel like I was constantly being swayed by people. But yeah, there was just an enormous amount right out the gate for this show, to the point where I used to keep a lost theories journal, like a literal like handwritten journal that I would like take notes at each episode and like come up with just the most crackpot things. Like I'd be looking for like labels on food and stuff and what does it mean. So the show like definitely started like what led to my career of just like trying to piece together theories and stuff started with Lost.
Amazing. So we can all thank Lost for everything that Lindsay now contributes to the world of culture. Is there anything else in the other subplots that I'm missing that happened in this episode that you want to chat about?
No, I think we've really covered everything. I'm always excited to talk about Kate. I do. It's really fun to like go back into this fandom and see how people are talking about her with so much more understanding than they used to back when I was a fan.
Yeah.
In the Live Journal days, there was a lot of slut shaming stuff. There was a lot of really horrific, horrific things people said about Kate, to the point that even then, as like a young woman, I felt really upset by it. So sort of watching her be reinterpreted and seeing how people are dealing with her now versus then has been really powerful for me.
Yeah, it's so funny because like I think the men are going to be faring a little bit less through the life of 2019, faring less well. And then the women, like particularly like Kate and Shannon, who I think got the brunt of that. I can't think of another character. Well, okay, we'll think about that later. But yeah, like Shannon was like very vilified by both men and women. And like, obviously she's set up to be bratty, but I think this unified theory that I'm sort of working on with Lost is that it like encourages empathy or sympathy as much as possible, as much empathy as we can find. So as much empathy as we can find for Shannon, despite the fact that she does some like truly shitty things, which we will see in next week's episode, which is about Boone and Shannon. But like finding out the worst of someone, right? Like the worst of some of the worst stuff about Kate is that she like helped orchestrate a bank robbery, you know, like this, she did some bad shit, right? And then finding a way to, you know, care for them or be worried about them anyway, I think is a powerful thing, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's why I'm a fan all these many years later, is just the characters are still characters that are so real to me. And it's because of that. It's because the show shows their faults and tries to make you love them no matter what they've done. And I don't know if shows always do that. And so it's something that feels kind of singular to Lost and singular to Damon Lindelof specifically. So, yeah.
Yeah. We should say that this episode was co-written by Jennifer Johnson, which is something that Neil pointed out, you know, and the Claire episode is written by Lynn Litt, so that they are having like some female writers come in and write for their female centric episodes. It's certainly still largely a male, writing team, but there's like, and they don't just have the women write for women and the men write for men, you know, they mix and match and stuff like that. But I do appreciate, you know, that unlike Game of Thrones, like if we're going to try to tell a story about complicated women, like let's try to bring in some women to tell those stories. So,
yeah,
that is something I appreciate. And then I guess the last spoiler free thing I will ask you about, cause I haven't had a chance to ask you about this on the podcast, I'm sort of asking everyone, is like for people who, have maybe heard about the reputation of the Lost ending, are maybe still grappling with the Game of Thrones ending, all that sort of stuff, like this many years later. Well, first of all, I'll ask you, like, did you have issues with the ending when you saw it the first time? What can you say in a spoiler free way? No, you did, like, you loved it or you thought it was fine, or like, what'd you think?
I loved it. It's okay. Something, you know, I will not spoil it all, I promise, but it is something that speaks very much to what I love about the show. And it just, yeah, no, I didn't have any issues with it. I think I was a little confused by it at first, but I didn't have like the immediate negative reaction. And I don't remember there even being such an extreme immediate negative reaction. I feel like it's a reputation that sort of really grew over time, which seems a little different than Game of Thrones to me. But I could be misremembering, so, yeah.
I remember there being a very extreme negative reaction, but I think it did become because the internet wasn't quite, like, if the internet was then what it is now, I think you would have seen the same thing that you saw in Game of Thrones. But since it wasn't like that, it just took a while for that.
Right.
So if people were on the fence, they're like, oh, wait, the majority of people say it sucks. Oh, it sucks. You know, it's sort of, I don't know, people can be swayed. I can be swayed easily by, groupthink on the internet. But yeah, I think it is a reputation that grew, but I also think it's a reputation that's ebbed. So yeah, like this many years later, I think people, I'm really super interested for us all to like revisit the ending when we finally get there. And, it's just something that like, no matter how I felt about the ending, and I think a little mixed, and I've just liked it more each time that I've revisited it. But like, no matter what, it never, and I feel the same way about Game of Thrones, it doesn't erase all the good things that came before, in the show, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I feel the exact same way. And I remember even telling friends that at the time, like people that sat with it wrong. I'm like, yeah, but you loved all these other seasons. And like, why does this one episode suddenly, like, that shouldn't take away from that love that you felt. And there's so much to love and Lost. There's a lot to criticize and hate also, but there's so much to love.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Well, any closing, whatever the case may be, or Lost thoughts before we go?
My only other thought was that it bothers me every time that I watch this episode, because I think it should be called Whatever the Kate May Be.
Oh.
Because the show, like, you know, Michael, maybe I'm just like confusing Michael Giacchino with this, who like loves to put in
really
the pun stuff. But I literally even wrote down Whatever the Kate May Be on accident when I was like going to take notes for this. So
his track names are so funny. My favorite one is a spoiler, which I think we talked about in the storm. But like they're very silly. His track names. I kind of like Whatever the Case May Be, since it's a phrase and there's a literal case on the episode and stuff like that. But yeah, that's funny. That's really funny. That's what you think. I keep calling, there's a later episode called Across the Sea, and I keep thinking it's called Beyond the Sea, and that, which is complicated by the fact that Beyond the Sea, the song Beyond the Sea, is a part of this week's episode. So, anyway, that's a crosswire in my brain. All right, Lindsay Romaine, where can people find your work on the internet?
Yeah, you can find me at Lindsay Romaine on Twitter, and you can also find my work on Nerdist.com.
All right. Well, we will definitely have you back for further Kate episodes. There's like one in particular that I would really love to chat with you about, and I can't wait. And otherwise, I will see you online, or I'll see you in the Slack.
Yes, I will see you there.
All right. Well, this is the part of the podcast where we thank our small council members. These are our Patreon subscribers at the $10 level or above. They get a bunch of extra goodies every month, including secret movie club and all sorts of bonus stuff. But also, they get their names read out on the podcast. So let us thank Crystal Shears Roberts, who's a new Small Council member. Thank you so much, Crystal. I think we met you at Con of Thrones. Also want to thank Kathy Schaberg, Scott Karnitz, Emily, David Colley, Jen Betke, Colby Waddell, Katie Boyd, Michelle Tepper, Jason Allen, Mark Stevenson, Jimmy Luck Taylor, Brian Kerr, Shanta Gonzalez, Federic Mars, did not nail that, John Chen, Siren Ports, Jennifer Caldwell, Anne Vardaman, Riley Tran, and Jennifer Trice. Thank you guys so much.
And I would like to thank Kristen Butterfield, Rosa, Jaina Gardner, Jamie Smith, David G.
David G.
Myra Figueroa, Melissa Beerley, Nathalie Sweet, Jan Carlo, Lord of the Soups and Warden of the Grill, Stephen Miller, William Eggert, Susan Shirley, Chris Rummel, Weed Detective, Molly Callahan, Gabriel Wusko, Pat Jukins, Byron Gilbert, Jaron Colvin, and Kaisha Solomon.
I too, as you may have guessed, have a list of people that we would love to thank. This includes Jennifer Hill, Angelica Cotto, Lauren Reed, Ivan Mejares, Grace O'Keefe, Jefferson Grubbs, Catherine Davis, Dickie Moe, Priscilla Kana, The Ghost of Ghost, D Donuts, Robin Nystrom, Alex Payton, Joe Galena, Aaron Badillo, Lauren Bree, Amy, Mother of Dragons, Breaker of Chains, Ole Bahiman. There we go. Okay, close. Probably not. Catherine Altmaier and Samantha Mason. Thank you all so very much for being on The Small Council.
On va danser le long des golfes clairs à des reflets d'argent amers, des reflets changeants sous la pluie. La mer au ciel d'été.
Boom! Crash! Blam! Kablawi! I'm gonna come up with new. Yeah, there we go. It's storm time. Oh, I got a whole shame bell thing going on. I like it.
And Nico.
Good job, Nico. Perfect timing.
Chill out.
It's like, it's like the bell could be heard through the through the entire world. That's how excited we are to talk about spoilers here, Joanna. Before we do our antagonist check-in, because My good buddy, Locke, has, you know, they've stolen the working axe, which is bad.
He only does one small shadowy thing in this episode.
That's right. Which you could maybe return to, but otherwise I think our antagonist is, as we rightly pointed out, Jack and Sawyer's, entitlement to get involved in other people's lives. What's this thing you keep talking about with Hurley in the case that we have to talk about?
Well, maybe if you have won the lottery and have to carry around large sums of money, you might be familiar with the Halliburton case. That's all. Right?
I mean, that's initially what I
imagine they were expensive.
Right. Or just that even if he doesn't have one himself, he is aware of how unpickable locks are for, yeah, money cases. It has to be money cases.
Whatever the money case may be.
That's right. Or maybe he has some sort of like super collectible he keeps in a Halliburton case.
The ones they sell now, Halliburton cases, which I guess they still, are like $600-$700 at the lowest. So yeah, that does seem like a thing a rich person would know.
Yeah,
like knowing a good watch from a cheap watch, which I don't, and I imagine rich people do, right? Someday I'll learn. Never mind. I'll just have to make more money. Back at the antagonist watch, yes, Locke has convinced Boone to steal the axe so they could work on the hatch with it, and at this point kind of gives Boone, I guess, more lip that is, I think, indicative of how what the relationship has become now, which is Locke is helpful to have, I think, another worker be, but is definitely talks down. They're not of equal partnership in this venture, which I think is what's supposed to be communicated by Locke scolding Boone for using inaccurate language about if he was followed. Right after he sort of like yelled at Shannon. I don't know what the episode's doing with the Boone stare that we attributed probably correctly to him not liking anybody flirting with Shannon, considering we get a Boone episode next week. But also just like living in a world where you're unspoiled about the two's relationship, are we supposed to think that maybe Locke and Boone are doing something more nefarious out in the jungle?
I mean, this was actually my question around Boone. Is, and it's another one of those when did the writers know questions, but like, is this the point where we can start to see them taking both Boone and Shannon down their eventual paths to their ends?
Well, like, I mean, I don't know
when where
they
decided that Boone's gonna die in season one.
I think they just honestly, okay, this is gonna be like, this is, I really love Ian Somerhalder, and I think that he is so good on The Vampire Diaries, but I think they decided once he did his episode, and his episode is not very good. You know what
okay.
I mean? And I think that
so
they decided,
the one we're watching next week?
Yeah. I think they decided, it's not like bad, but it's just sort of like, you're like, incest, I mean, like,
incest wasn't as palatable as it was.
It's not just that. It's just sort of like, it feels like a little inert. And like I said, I've been really excited to talk about that episode because I read a bunch of, like, I read all these, like, Ian Somerhalder interviews about, like, why he thinks he was written off the show early and stuff like that. that was not always the plan. And he wasn't told until after he shot his episode. So that's when he found out. It's not necessarily like maybe the writers knew before that, but I always think about Joss Whedon once said that, when he decided to try to do a spinoff for the character of Angel, played by David Boreanaz, a spinoff from Buffy Vampire Slayer, is this one Angel-centric episode called Amends from season 3, where Boreanaz has to play Angel through time. It's like a big flashback Angel episode, and then he has to do like, "Am I a righteous man?" It's the whole thing, and then it snows. Oh, guys, it's amazing. But but Joss Whedon has talked about like that was the moment he knew that Boreanaz could carry his own episode, his own series. He's like, "Give him this episode." Boreanaz knocks it out of the park. And then he gets his own series. And I feel like they're like, all right, let's watch this Boone episode. It's not very good. we've either written the character poorly, or Ian has taken the wrong tack with it, or whatever the case may be.
Or
I have a third theory. Hit me.
Do you think that at a certain point they looked at the chemistry between Boone and Shannon versus the chemistry between Shannon and Saeed and were like, we kind of like the one over the other?
I don't think Shannon said you'd have good chemistry.
Oh, see, I kind of, this even in this episode, I kind of read that as okay chemist, like a good start.
It's Naveen Andrews trying, but apparently this is another interview I read that it was Naveen Andrews' idea that Saeed and Shannon like have a thing. Because I feel like initially they were like, everybody loves Kate. And I kind of feel like Naveen Andrews is like, what if I like someone else? I don't know. I don't know why. I'll need to dig into more why Naveen Andrews thought like Shannon and Saeed should be together. But like most people I know think it's a very weird pairing.
Interesting.
And like doesn't fully work. Like don't really understand what he sees. It feels slightly forced. But I don't know. Maybe our listeners will disagree with that. Please email us at host@stormpodcast. I don't know. What's our email?
Host@stormpodcast.com.
If Shannon and Saeed is your OTP, please do email us in and let me know.
I mean, they definitely have a healthier relationship than Kate and
anyone else.
Either
in this episode,
of her suitors in this episode.
Absolutely.
I don't know. It's weird, and I guess this is something we'll hopefully find out as we watch. But I remember liking Saeed and Shannon, especially toward by the end.
When they're trying to get you to care really hard.
It.
Yeah.
They really did. Yeah. Well, and it was like Saeed was the only one who was nice to Shannon ever. Like everyone else sort of writes her off.
No, you know who's so nice to Shannon is Walt. That's my favorite Shannon scene.
That's true.
When Walt gives her Vincent. Oh, that's a big. Oh, I can't wait till we get to the finale.
But he also,
guys.
Isn't he like gives it to her because he's like, you need something to do?
We're going to talk about it again. It's the most beautiful thing ever. He's like, will you take care of my dog for me? And she's like, I can't do anything. I can't, I'm useless. I can't do anything. And she's like, why would I take care of your dog? And he's like, well, when I lost my mom and I was sad, everyone treated me like I didn't exist and no one would talk to me. And so I talked to Vincent and made me feel better. So maybe you could talk to Vincent about your brother. It's really good. It's really good. And I feel like the writers were like, let's kill Boone. Killing Boone. I mean, they kind of fridged Boone to make try to make Shannon even more interesting. You know what I mean? They're like, okay, Shannon and Boone, two problems. Well, let's kill one and maybe that will solve their problem. And then it like, then like doesn't. Nope. And then they're like, never mind. Let's pretend those two sibs never happened, you know, sort of thing. I like both of those performers, but I think it was the right move to take them off the board. Yeah. Anyway.
Slow motion Nikki and Paolo.
Slow motion Nikki and Paolo. Anyway, what else do we need to talk about Stormwise in this episode? Well, Lamaire never winds up being anything, right? Do we see Rousseau like sing it went to her like unborn baby?
No,
in
they
the
just
flashback?
Needed some diegetic music for the montage at the end of this episode, and Hurley's mix is all feel good. So why would you throw in? I think. I bet there's some sort of like weird thing on the special features of the season one DVD. It's like, and we didn't know this actress could sing. That's what this feels like to me.
All right. Well, There you
Unless
go.
There's something special. Is there something special?
I'm looking right now.
Yeah, it has an entry on Lostpedia.
Oh, that means it could probably be coming back, and I could be very wrong about how that turned out.
No.
No, it's the first of several songs that are diegetic, which is the score sort of what matches it.
Right.
Or the... Yeah, it's being performed, and that's how we're getting
the way in which the score. Well, no, not just that, but the way in which the score incorporates a diegetic song. In like Giacchino takes a song that's, you know, because as we mentioned, I think we mentioned one of the songs that cropped up earlier was in this season was one of the only one of two instances of non-diegetic music. So all other music is diegetic.
But this is the first time that it's adapted into the score.
Yeah, which is something they do multiple times over the course of the series.
Good. Excellent. Not as far as All Along the Watchtower, though, at least not that I remember right now. That's for another series that I won't specify in case you haven't seen it.
According to Lossopedia, the end credits for the French version of Finding Nemo are actually just Beyond the Sea, not La Mer. So... They try.
So it's another one of those lost things where it's not even correct. We've had several of those so far.
That's just because it's in a different universe existing with all the other favorite fictional properties so that one of them could crop up to be a lost sequel or prequel later on.
We should say that Across the Sea is the name of a famous lost episode with Allison Janney, not to be confused with Beyond the Sea, which is a famous episode of The X-Files. So, you know.
Not to be confused with Beyond the Wall, which is a famously just okay episode of Game of Thrones.
Yes, none of those things are confusing in the slightest when you put them that way.
We really clarified it for everyone, I feel. Good job, team.
I guess only spoiler thing that we could talk about this episode or that we could possibly talk about this episode to me is that Kate kind of didn't kill anybody.
Oh, I know.
Well, not this particular guy.
When we get to that episode, you're like, well, she killed her stepdad.
Yeah. That's why I revised this particular guy.
She didn't kill this guy.
Well, not directly. Isn't she still...
She's in.
It is a officer involved shooting Neil.
She's in, and she screams at him to get out of the car like multiple times, and then he doesn't get out of the car, and then he gets caught in a crossfire, hail of bullets. But that guy, as I bored Neil in the airport about earlier this week, is played by Sean Astin's brother, Mackenzie Astin. We'll get to it. But I'm just saying, Neil and I had a really long conversation about Mackenzie Astin that was like pretty one-sided. So,
yeah.
As we were coming home from Con of Thrones, which way I was very tired.
Yeah. You were really tired.
Yeah, it takes us a while to get there, but we will be getting there. Otherwise, I think we're just waiting for some more mystery to pop off on this.
I think it's Born to Run, right? Isn't it? It's before the finale episodes in this season.
Yeah.
Nice.
The other thing that sort of projects forward.
I thought it was the incident for some reason.
What?
No, it's Born to Run.
Do we revisit it in the incident for some reason? I thought the plane story was in the incident.
What's the story of Born to Run then?
Born to Run is they find the tape and then later the plane is explained in the incident. Okay, never mind. I'm back. Dave's back and remembers the series again. Thank you for that small detail.
No, the plane is in that too because isn't it all in their little time capsule? The plane and the tape?
The plane's in the time capsule, but we don't see him explain the plane from being like his first flight until like the incident. Like Baby Kate isn't until the incident, I don't think.
Okay. We'll find out together.
We'll find out together in 2024.
But the point being, Mackenzie Astin, Sean Astin's brother,
definitely ends up being him whenever he shows up.
Is in season one, so that's important to know.
Mm-hmm.
Nice.
I had one more thing I wanted to point out in the storm.
Yes, please.
Which is, it's easy to be struck by how extremely confident Rose is about Bernard, which I feel like when you watch it back, knowing that, you know, we're going to eventually get to the tail section, is just this, it feels so obvious. Like Rose is just overwhelmingly faithful that Bernard is still alive. And the show is just, it's right there in front of everybody's faces. And I like it.
Maybe this is,
I don't know,
sort of, maybe this is sort of what made me kick up against the Christianity of it before, because I can see how if I'm watching it for the first time and I don't know that, that's like super sad. Like, because the reality is that tail section blew the fuck up and everybody, like, we've been told that. We have no reason not to believe that. And so her faith at that point actually becomes kind of sad that Charlie takes it on, because that could mean, in theory, Claire could be dead and we've just, like, forgot about
it. Ooh, I don't know if I ever thought of it that way. I like it.
There's faith and there's denial, and I don't think we're supposed to know specifically what side they're on, even if it's very touching interpersonally. But we'll see. Who knows? I'm super happy that the Jesus-specific Christianity becomes a little bit more subtle as we move on into greater, you know, light versus dark, black versus white, good versus evil. Let's not get immaculate births all wrapped into it if we don't need to.
I don't know. I just think that, like, if we're going to explore stuff like mediumship, which, like, as we implied in Raised by, like, when I was talking to Amy and Raised by Another, like, there's stuff later in the series with, like, Miles and all this sort of stuff. Like, there's a lot of spiritual stuff. So if you're going to, like, explore that, I think it makes sense to have people who believe in Jesus and God and the Bible and
it's one of the show's strengths is diversity, not only of like its cast, but of the stories that it wants to tell about its characters.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I think that as they're exploring faith, it's you know, they kind of go through a lot of different kinds of faith.
Yeah, and like...
Sure, I'm just saying there's a big difference between here, where we cut to a cross, and that's what's there, and the end with multi-denominational church, which is still Christian-tinged, but I feel like they figured out how to make it about all things, where maybe they just had to find a way into it that was recognizable to the majority of the audience at the time, which would have been, you know, Christianity-based faith applied to Magic Island.
I just think it's more like it goes back to that whole, like, Survivor as an inspiration for Lost thing, where, like, if you think about Survivor or Lord of the Flies or whatever the case might be, I'm just going to say as many times as I can, you know, what would... You want to think about, like, what would I do? What would my coping mechanism be on the island? How would I deal with this extreme situation? And for plenty of people in the world, they would lean heavily on their Christian faith. So, you know, I think that that's I think it's a good thing to have represented in the story. How would I, Joanna, react? We already know. I would go for a swim early on and get caught in a riptide. Yeah, yeah.
And then they'd be like, oh, man.
Well,
you really fucked up Dr. Jack. You gave him a complex for the rest of his time on this island.
Poor Joanna.
All right, guys. Unless we have anything else to say, where could people find more of your work on the internet until the next time we convene for the Boon episode?
Hearts and minds.
Hearts and minds.
Hearts and minds.
And bodies of siblings. It's okay. They're step siblings. It's fine. This is fine.
So, Neil, where can people find more of your work online?
Oh, well, you can get me over at filmschoolrejects.com. You can always follow me on Twitter at rejects. And don't forget, follow the show at Storm Podcast. And send us emails if you have things you want to tell us. hosts@stormpodcast.com.
And Joanna Robinson.
You can find me on VanityFair.com. You follow me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This. And this episode is coming out on the 24th. By then, I will have announced that you can also hear me talking about my so-called life on a new podcast called Boiler Room. The Boiler Room. BoilerRoomCast.com to look into all the details on that. Check
Ooh, fun.
Yeah, fun.
Mystery boxes. We should probably remember to plug these things before the storm.
Yeah, I just wasn't sure about the timing of this. I'll do that next time. There's time.
Good job, Storm listeners. You get to hear about it first. Everybody else is going to have to wait a week to hear about Joanna's My So-Called Life podcast. So yeah, get on it. What was that URL again?
BoilerRoomCast.com. This is a project I'm doing with the lovely Kristen Russo, who you may have heard on the Sawyer episode.
There you go. Always making hashtag more content here if you're a host of Storm of Spoilers. I'm Dave Gonzalez. You can find me on the Fighting in the War Room podcast, at Thrillist.com, at Polygon.com, and urging you right here on the Storm of Lost Rewatch podcast to not fall down.